Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update, an original podcast from Charles Schwab, provides an information-packed daily market recap in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcasts.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal. Right now, Carl Weinberg with us, Chief Economist, High Frequency Economics. Lisa wants to dive into the international field. Carl, I've got to go to your scathing China note. I believe it was yesterday where you say flat out, we can't trust the Chinese data. How close to worser is China?
Good morning, Tom. Good morning, Lisa. China's numbers are surprisingly strong. The trade numbers are surprisingly strong. We can make up a story for the import side that perhaps points to a very, very big drop in the volume of imports, assuming that import prices went up. But the export numbers are just over the top. It's hard to believe that with the ports closed for at least half of the month of May, that we saw a 15% year-over-year rise in exports. So I'm skeptical of the numbers that we're seeing. Of course, we'll get more numbers this week. We're going to see retail sales and industrial production and fixed investment spending at the end of this week. Let's see if they paint a darker picture of the economy, more aligned to what we expect to see.
Carl, do you see anything that's going to put a crimp on the inflationary kind of pressure that we're seeing upward in the near term?
Well, the central banks are going to put a crimp in things.
Aside from them.
Well, but that's really the core story here. Every time central banks have gone out shooting for inflation, they've caused a recession. And almost every time we've seen a recession, we've seen prices fall off dramatically. You know, few people remember how fast inflation dropped from just before the spring of 2008, the economic peak, until 6 months later, we went from inflation to deflation, and oil went from $140 a barrel to $35 a barrel. Now, that was a really big hit to income, really sudden, really unexpected. But every time we look back in history and we've seen the economy go into a recession or a period of slow growth, we've seen prices slow rather dramatically. So that's the story here. You know, you look at the current data, and it's very fair to say there's no evidence in the current data that inflation is slowing. That's true. But that assumes all other things remain equal, and all other things will not remain equal. The hike in interest rates that we're seeing from all the central banks around the world, except for the Japanese, is going to slow growth. And that's what's going to bring prices down.
This is incredibly important, Carl, because a lot of people were saying that the only way for the Fed to achieve a soft landing was if other aspects coordinated with it, exogenous risks abated and allowed a weaker or a slowdown in inflation that was faster than some people had been expecting. If that is not the case, Carl, is it basically, they're going to cause a recession? They need to cause a recession in order to get price control into the market.
Well, you know, Lisa, we heard Fed Chair Powell say a few testimonies ago that the Fed's track record on soft landings isn't really that good, that he could only think of one or two instances in the last 50 years when they actually achieved one. Maybe this time will be different, but there were six episodes of interest rate hikes by the Fed that preceded or were associated with the last six big economic downturns in the United States. And we see the same thing for the Europeans and for the English as well. So, that's certainly going to be a factor. The exogenous factors are going to go away, All right, for sure, oil prices are not going to continue to rise. And again, as we saw back both in 2008 and in 2020, if the economy gets slammed hard, oil prices can go from $140 a barrel to $35 a barrel in 6 months. They can fall just as fast as they went up. And that's, I think, got to be part of everybody's thinking.
Well, the thinking goes that the cure for higher prices in the commodity complex eventually is higher prices, that eventually demand destruction will kick in. We have seen sentiment waning, Carl, and yet you haven't necessarily seen the robust demand destruction when it comes to actual consumption, to consumers being willing to spend their money. When does that start to happen in a more robust way?
Yeah. Hi. Good morning, Kaylee. Yeah. I mean, we just have to be a little bit patient to see it work out. Right now, we see evidence consumers in the United States are running up their credit card debt. We see evidence that they're reducing their savings. These are all ways to cushion the impact of a drop in real income, which is what's being caused by the higher energy prices and other prices that households are facing. But that can't go on forever. And I think we just have to be patient that it's coming. Everything we know about economics says it's in the works. It's just not here just yet.
What should they do tomorrow, Carl? You've been doing this for decades. You've got tons of experience back to Arthur Burns and even McChesney Martin. What should Jerome Powell do tomorrow?
Well, I think he's got to pursue the course of convincing people that the Fed is going to do whatever it takes to fight inflation, to not let inflation expectations become entrenched in wage demands and consumer spending behavior. Ben Bernanke had a piece in the New York Times today saying exactly that. And I got to agree with former chair Bernanke that that's the most important thing that the Fed can do. You know, we've been teasing high frequency readers with an article from the Economic Bulletin of the ECB from May of 2010, written by the Bundesbank, explaining why Germany fared better in the great inflation of the 70s than the United States.
Right.
And their answer was they established a credible target for monetary growth, a credible target for inflation, and they stuck to it. And I think that's the most important thing that the Fed can do right now.
Carl Weinberg, thank you so much. Great briefing here as we go to the Fed show tomorrow. We'll have that for you in the 1 p.m. hour. Michael McKee in Washington. We're going to change the show right now, and we can do that with Katie Kaminsky, Chief Research Strategist, Alpha Simplex, who's having a killing year shorting the space. Katie, I want to go back to what you've got tattooed to your brain from the CTA crew, which is anti-martingale theory, which is when you're successful, you increase your bets. When you're not, you have your bets. Are you utilizing in your record year of getting shorts right, are you utilizing anti-martingale theory to take bigger short bets?
I'd have to say yes, in the sense that we do really well when things are difficult, when there's dislocations, and when people don't know what to do. And that's exactly what's happening this year. We have complacency, we have denial, and we have fear. That is a perfect scenario where markets can be a little bit more behavioral and less efficient. And thus, following the trend is actually a very diligent and less emotional-based way to actually trade such difficult markets.
Are you able, and I'm thinking of the work of Wells Wilder of the late 1970s and looking at something mumbo-jumbo like ADX-DMI, does Bitcoin trend? Can you guys take a short on Bitcoin and extend it out here at 22,000 right now?
So I have to admit, I don't trade Bitcoin because I'm a risk manager and there's just a lot of risk there. But what I would say, if you did look at a trend signal in Bitcoin, is that it's definitely gone down quite a bit, but you might need to see a little bit of recovery before we would actually consider that we're having a new trend. I mean, I think that is a very difficult call, but it has significantly reverted from what would have been its previous highs.
Katie, when do you know to close out your shorts?
So we have a process where we're very much about focus on seeing confirmation in data. So if I give you an example, people have just been calling this peak of inflation. We say you can't call a peak until the peak is over. And so I think this is an example. People were too early to call the peak in inflation. We're going to start calling those type of peaks when we actually see that the market confirms that they are going down or that prices are going down.
So, Katie, if it's too early to call the peak in inflation, is it too early to call the bottom in the equity market?
Certainly. Unfortunately, that's the case. We need to see more confirmation that we're kind of starting to see some sort of recovery. I think it's easy to react on one day's moves, particularly a day like yesterday. We may have some reversal, but we do actually really need to see some confirmation instead of just reacting to one day.
So what are you looking at specifically in the data to indicate that we are seeing peak inflation? You're saying you have to look for confirmation in markets. What are those signs?
I think the biggest things that we look are empirical trends in asset prices. And what's interesting right now is that you're seeing very, very similar patterns to what we saw during a rising rate environment. And I think what you said earlier in the show about, is this the true bottom of the falling interest rate environment? What we have seen is that we're going to tend to be short in a rising rate environment, particularly when we're going close to an inversion type point, where we're moving into a more recessionary environment. And those are particularly the technical signals we've seen in bonds. And this is actually quite interesting because during those environments, our strategies are going to tend to be 70% short bonds. And if we move into that environment, we're going to see a lot more short bond signals over the next few years.
Is it a crowded trade? I mean, you're in a trend-based, clearly you've hit the ball out of the park this year, but are you concerned that everybody's on board with Katie Kaminsky?
I mean, that's always a question when you're a trend follower. If you follow the trend, you got to get out the doors. But the truth is, very few people are comfortable shorting bonds, and very few people have been comfortable with the trade we've had this year. And that's, I think, why it's been such an interesting year to be a trend follower, because we're doing things that haven't worked since 1994.
Very quickly here, you levered up. I mean, come on, nobody's listening, Katie. You can tell me, are you 3-to-1, 20-to-1? Are you doing a 1998 Redux?
No, I mean, we're definitely risk managers in the sense that we run at about 12 vol, which is much lower than what you'd see in the S&P if you looked over a long horizon. I think it's about diversification and finding opportunities across the entire spectrum of bonds, across a large geographical region, and really sort of following macro trends with an eye to many different trades.
Katie Kaminsky, thank you so much. Greatly appreciate it. And congratulations on getting so many facets of this market right.
Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Join host Keith Lansford for this information-packed daily market recap, delivered in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcast. That's schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Always prescient. It's Federated Hermes. Linda Dussel joins us there, senior equity strategist. Is your team under the desk? I mean, Linda, are people hiding under the desk this morning?
I have to give my team credit because when we started this year, we said that we thought you'd see a lot of volatility in it. Cash might actually be king. It was the first time in my career at Federated Hermes that neither the bond representative nor the stock representative was very excited about their areas. So I think we're going through what we thought we would do. In our conversations at the office, we're saying that this is going a lot quicker, though, than what we thought.
Linda, is this it? Is this the cathartic puke? Tom accused me of not being very ladylike, but you don't want to buy when people are scared. And yet here we are, and that typically is the best time to buy. Is this it?
No, I don't think it's it. I mean, we see what's happening in the crypto. Crypto's having their puke, that's guaranteed. But I'm still seeing and hearing too many buy the dip ideas. We only came down 20% on the S&P, and I guess we tested it once here with a quick 10% bounce on really pretty poor volume. But I don't see why we shouldn't do even more damage than that with all the money that was pushed into this system. So many people buying up, so many assets out there. And that does have to be wound back, and I think it might end up being probably a recession and probably maybe a couple of hundred more points downside on the S&P.
Linda, Lisa raised this briefly, the idea that now the market is kind of giving the Fed permission in some sense to move 75 basis points, or at least it wouldn't be all too surprising. Would the greater downside risk to equities be a Fed that acts too aggressively, is too hawkish, or is too dovish and there's little faith that they're able to rein in inflation?
Yeah, I think, how it works out, we're not so concerned. I think a 1% move would be a big shock, just a big shock to the markets, the 75 basis points versus 50 basis points. Like, I think we're kind of in the situation that says, whatever, they're going to keep on going. We find it interesting, very recently, the betting out there for the Fed terminal rate is now up to almost 4%. So where we end this is very important. And if you're talking about the PPI, how PPI and CPI particularly come down, because we saw the M2 money growth peak in February of 2021, and historically about 13 months later, the CPI, the core starts to pull back down, which you might say it did a little bit in the last 2 months. So it might come down fairly quickly. I'm not betting on that right now, but that's what we really, really have to watch. And the Fed will just keep going on and being data dependent. And then QT is, is just a big mystery to all of us.
Well, Linda, you mentioned PPI, which raises the question of input costs and margins. Are margin estimates still too high for the rest of this year?
Yeah, that's what we're particularly concerned about is, is the news coming out of Target was that like just the tip of the iceberg as to what might come next, and might more and more industries have to report, even if they had a good second quarter, that their outlook is that margins will be squeezed, because to date it was all PE multiple contraction. And if we start to pull down our earnings estimates, that's going to be a double whammy here for the market. So it could be a tough couple of months here.
Linda, thank you so much. Greatly appreciated. Right now, from TD Securities, someone who looks at all currencies, someone who's been dead on about dollar resiliency, Mark McCormick is our global head of FX strategy. But we're going to do something different this time, folks. Get out your pens and paper and take notes. Replay the video when you hear it. Mark McCormick, a primer on Japan. Mark McCormick, what yen level does Japan need where the system falls apart, this rigged system of modern monetary theory that they have?
Well, thanks for having me. Yeah, I don't think it's a particular level. I think we're getting to the point now where you think about, is there a level you'd like to fade dollar yen, given the fact that JGBs are moving, all these central banks are moving, everyone's imported inflation from around the world, and we're trying to sequence which central banks are moving. It looks like the ECB is ready to move, the SMB is ready to move, and the major question is when does the BOJ go? I think it's not coming in the next month, it's not coming this week, but I think we should be priming ourselves that 135 is probably a top in dollar yen, and we want to think about what level in terms of maybe medium term or longer term fair value do we get to. The biggest long term trade in terms of valuation is dollar yen is the most overvalued currency in the G10. So if we think about that things over quarters, I think a level that's important is probably 115 to 120 to think about what is an anchor point for dollar yen relative to the policy expectations.
How do you and your Asian team envision you will migrate from 135 to 115, 120, or even stronger yen, a lower statistic? Can it be smooth reaction functions, or is it a mess in jump conditions?
It's absolutely the latter. It's jump conditions. It's definitely a mess. I would say a big part of it is there's some interesting things that are driving yen that I don't think a lot of people spend their time on. And I think one thing most importantly is the movement in energy prices. And Japan is a massive importer of energy and other commodities around the world. So Japan's current account surplus has been eroded. Yeah. And at the exact same time, there's a tremendous amount of foreign direct investment by Japanese corporates out of Japan, which is also weakening the yen. The question is whether or not moving BOJ policy and the change in the U.S. equity markets and the markets, people leaving the United States equity markets and looking for things that are cheap, undervalued, right, and underpositioned, this is what can help turn the ship for the yen and then say the next 6 months. This is not, again, an immediate risk, but this is kind of that nonlinear effect. If the BOJ moves, U.S. equity markets rolling over, and people are looking for other places to put their money, Japan is going to flag really well on that outlook maybe in the next 6 months or so.
I can't emphasize enough, Lisa, how this is not your father's Japan. This is not about Toyotas and Toshibas. It is a changed Japan, and obviously because of China.
Obviously because of China and also because of the Bank of Japan's potentially futile effort to control a bond market that can no longer be considered a market. Mark, at what point is the Bank of Japan fooling itself, continuing to buy bonds now at a record pace in order to keep yields pegged at this ultra low level?
Well, they're still doing it now. I think, again, they're kind of getting to the point where the cost benefit doesn't work in their favor. They tried this again earlier in the year, and we were talking about terms of trade shocks and higher interest rates and why would the BOJ continue with yield curve control, and they continue to do it. I think what we're starting to see is the rhetoric's changing. There's mixed messages from policymakers. They're trying to coordinate a policy response between the BOJ and the Ministry of Finance. So there's scope here that the boat is turning, and markets are sniffing it out. So I think this is, again, an interesting concept that the policy itself is broken. Markets know it's broken, and they're starting to actively try to find ways to push against it.
So, Mark, how big would the move be in the yen if the Bank of Japan were to abandon the rate peg?
It'd be significant. Again, it'd be a knee jerk. Again, we're talking a lot about, people are discussing intervention. I think intervention is less palpable than the actual policy change. But if we see the policy change, it could see, knee jerk could be 5%. In the very short run. But again, a lot of it will hinge back onto where we are in the global market cycle, where's risk appetite, where are we at relative to the Fed and other central banks. But the knee jerk could absolutely be worth a significant move in yen.
Okay, so on the subject of risk appetite, Mark, is that more so what has driven the recent bout of strength in the dollar rather than expectations of tighter Federal Reserve policy?
I think that's a great question, because a lot of this year, people have focused on relative themes. We've talked a lot about terms of trade, growth, relative central banks. What's happened since April, and we even got a little sliver of it last month, is people gave up on the broader themes. And what happened is that the dollar and the Fed became all-encompassing. And what the Fed has done through tightening financial conditions is created an equity recession. And risk sentiment has deteriorated, along with kind of the focus on China's zero COVID, what's going on with Russia and Ukraine, and how it impacts Europe. But essentially, we're back to that trade now. We're not kind of thinking about terms of trade. You're not buying commodity exporters. You're actually just saying, I'm selling commodity importers like euro, yen, and a couple other currencies. But what's happening is the strength of the dollar is a single meta theme that is basically deteriorating risk sentiment. And what we're doing is bringing short-term cash back into U.S. dollars. So it's really like a one-trick move here, where stronger Fed policy, tighter financial conditions, just as a single strong dollar with really no other themes happening in FX.
Well, and you mentioned the headwinds also facing the euro and Europe more broadly. How realistic is parity?
I think parity is definitely a lively discussion. I think, again, if you were to look at option pricing, which is an interesting way to look at things, in the next 3 months, it's still only about a 15% chance that we hit parity. I think obviously we're looking for, we have a trade on, we're looking to revisit those lows under 104. I think the prospects of parity, though, are challenging in this environment, because we've already seen the Fed be priced now for 75, 75, 50, 50, and we're already back at a 4% terminal rate.
I got to leave it there, Mark, just because of time. Mark McCormick, thank you for the primer on Japan. Really, really appreciate it.
Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Join host Keith Lansford for this information-packed daily market recap, delivered in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcasts. That's schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
David Rubenstein on Vinod Khosla. What to me is so important is Ian Bremmer's essay last year on the power of technology. You talked to Mr. Khosla about technology and the tension between China and the United States. Who holds the power?
Well, Vinod Khosla, for those who don't know, has been one of the leading venture capital investors in the last several decades, first at Kleiner Perkins and now at his own firm, Khosla Ventures. And he is an Indian immigrant. He came to the United States, got his degree at Carnegie Mellon and then Stanford Business School, started Sun Microsystems, as you said, one of the founders there, and really has made some of the most impressive venture investments over the last several decades, making billions of dollars for his investors. He said that he thought there was a war, perhaps a techno-economic war between China and the United States that could arise over the next 20 years. And he thinks that his native country, India, could be an ally in the United States in that war. There's no doubt that there's technology tension now between China and the United States, and he thinks the venture capital community can play a big role in trying to moderate that tension to some extent and maybe bringing those countries together by cooperating to some extent, if possible, on technology investments.
And David, as you as a leader on this, and I want to bring in Dr. Bremmer's thoughts from his essay last year, there has to be a responsibility on the part of the young Turks of technology in America to think internationally and think interdependently. Are you optimistic they're able to do that?
Well, I think they're more likely to be able to do it than our political leaders are going to be able to do it, because I think the political leaders are right now at loggerheads about how to cooperate. But certainly the business people are willing to cooperate and can, if there are not government challenges. Sometimes the government puts blocks in between between cooperation between venture investors from China or India or United States. So I think the technology community recognizes it has the future of the global economy in its hands to some extent, because so much of what we're now doing, the way we live, is dependent on technology investments. 20 years ago, people wouldn't have said they could. They didn't know about Google. They didn't know about Apple. They didn't know about Facebook. And now we can't live without some of these companies, or Amazon as well.
Well, we can't live without some of these companies, and yet they have seen their share prices decline rapidly in remarkable fashion this year. Valuations really coming in across the tech space, David. What were his thoughts around that, on these valuations becoming a bit more depressed?
Well, it's one thing when you had the bubble burst in 2000 or 1999 and 2000, because you had companies then had no revenues and had essentially no earnings at all. Now you've got gigantic companies, Apple, Amazon, Google, Facebook, Netflix, that have large amounts of revenues and earnings. So yes, maybe the valuation is a little bit high today. I wouldn't think that these companies are going away the way that some of the companies went away in 1999 and 2000. These companies are now embedded in the fabric of our society, and I just think their valuations may fluctuate. but it's not like they're going away.
Okay, well, then let's talk about some other more nascent companies that maybe are seeking venture money. The exit may be getting a little bit more difficult. It would be a rough market to go public in. It is a rough market to raise capital in. I mean, how is venture changing in an environment where money is no longer free?
There's no doubt that valuations have come down in the private market as well as the public market, but these things happen from time to time. The question is whether it's a good company or not. Take SpaceX, for example. It just raised money at a very large valuation, I think a valuation of over $1 trillion. And they raised $1.7 billion, I believe it was, at a very high valuation. I think the valuation was $125 billion. I think eventually they think they might get it to $1 trillion. But there's a valuation where $125 billion, more or less, valuation for SpaceX is still a large amount of money to raise in the private sector at a large valuation. So the technology valuations have come down for sure, but they're not exactly disappearing and going to zero.
David, very quickly here, we've got to get back to these crazy markets. You said a number of months ago, maybe weeks ago, that the genie's out of the bottle on crypto. We are seeing painful losses in Bitcoin right now with announcements from people that immensely respect Carlyle and what you've done for years. Give us an update on Bitcoin and the rest. Is it believable?
Well, I'm not the leading expert on the subject, but my view would be that when I said the genie's out of the bottle, I don't think these things are disappearing. Their values will fluctuate for sure. But suppose you bought Bitcoin at 50 cents or a dollar, as many people did, and now it's at, 20-some thousand dollars still very high. So sure, if you bought it at $60,000, you've lost a lot of money. And I'm not saying these are great investments, but I think these are investments that aren't going to go away. And I don't think the whole crypto economy is going to collapse, nor do I think blockchain is going to disappear. Blockchain is an important part of a lot of these cryptocurrencies. So we're obviously in a market decline, and in a market decline, everything goes down. So it's not surprising that something that is as ephemeral as crypto would go down. But I don't think people are going to basically abandon the whole concept of cryptocurrencies just because the market's down for the last couple of weeks.
David, thank you so much. David Rubenstein with Vinod Khosla, and look for that. This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.